Hello, friends. This is your friend, Kent C. Dodds, and I'm super excited to be joined by my friend, Justin McMurdy. Say hi, Justin.
Hey.
So Justin and I are actually like one of the longer time friends that I've had in the tech community. We go back to 2014, 2015-ish. We went to school together, but in the same program. And I remember you in the program. So it was probably 2013 or somewhere.
Yeah, something like that. It's been a long time that we've known each other.
Yeah, good times. And I convinced you to come work with me at Alianza a few years ago. That was a good time.
It was great.
Yeah, really enjoyed that. Learned so much. It was such a cool place to work. We've both been a couple other places since then. So it's been a while. We've been keeping up and stuff. But the people listening don't know you at all, and that's such a shame. So Justin, can you tell us about yourself?
Yeah, of course. My name's Justin McMurdy. That is my Twitter handle. It's very original. I love Star Wars. I am a father, a spouse, open source software maintainer. I don't know. I love technology. I love what we can do with it. I love the possibilities that it gives us. Talking about myself is a little bit weird sometimes, but I think I'll lead with I love Star Wars and end with I love Star Wars.
Very good. Yeah. What did you think of the most recent reincarnations of Star? Well, not reincarnations, but like the most recent Star Wars movies.
I liked things about all of them. I go against the grain here. I really loved The Last Jedi Episode 8, and I really did not enjoy the final movie, but I found things that I enjoyed about all of them. And one of the things I love about Star Wars is that no matter, it's very widely open to interpretation. Everyone can find something about it that they enjoy, and there's strong opinions out there, and the fandom can get a little bit toxic, but, if you just respect other people's opinions and like, talk about the parts you both enjoy, you can have a really good conversation with people, even if they liked a movie you hated and vice versa.
I actually haven't seen the most recent Star Wars. I know it's terrible of me, but I did
actually
hear that...
I think that's fine.
I did hear that there was one scene where they're like riding horses on the like out in space on the ship. Is that a thing? Like, is that real?
Yeah, it was interesting.
We don't have to get into that, but that was surprising to me. Anyway, we are not here to talk about Star Wars, although that would be an enjoyable subject. We're actually talking on Zoom, and we both have some Star Wars related backgrounds, or space related backgrounds anyway, in our current quarantined circumstance. So I wanted to talk with you about microservices for the front end. So what is that even like? Just to give us a quick intro to maybe microservices in general, just the concept, and then like, how does that even make sense for the front end? Where does that apply?
Yeah. Microservices is I think is really cool, but let's take it just like you're saying, let's take a step back and discuss it as a topic. Like, most applications on the back end and on the front end are built as a monolith. So it's all in one project. There's one, maybe it's Webpack, maybe it's Rollup, maybe it's like MooTools. I don't know. There's one build, and at the end you have one bundle. And you might have code splits in there, and you deploy that one bundle to a CDN or Artifactory or however you host your website and on the front end. And that is your application. And so there's usually one Git repo that represents your entire application. And the same is true on the back end. They'll have, that's where the term services comes from, because unlike the front end, they're not shipping code to the client usually. They're running code on the back end that has to be available all the time. The idea is to pare down scope. So instead of having one service, one back end service that handles every request and does every single thing, you just break off chunks. Like, oh, this one handles updating users, and this one handles updating tasks, and this one handles sending emails. And so instead of having one service or a giant monolith, you have 4, 5, 6, 20, 100 microservices.
And so, like, what's the benefit of splitting it up? Like, let's talk about the costs and the benefits, because, like, nothing comes without trade-offs, of course. What are the trade-offs that we need to consider when we're thinking about splitting up our application into these microservices?
Yeah. I traditionally have worked on the front end most of my career. And so most of my perspective is going to be front end based, but I do have some experience on the back end. So I'll talk about mostly front end, but back end as well. So the pros and cons are the same on both sides. It's a different paradigm. And so there's a lot of training that goes involved for different people to understand the different deployment processes. Their system is actually slightly more complex in some ways, but on the pro side, you gain some performance benefits where you can scale up services by themselves. So for example, I mentioned like an email service. Let's say that was just a really heavy service. It had to do a lot of work. If everything was in one service, then I have to scale up for the email service, the entire thing. So what if I actually don't need all those resources for everything else, but the email service could be using up a lot of bandwidth or CPU cycles? If I split that off into its own service, then I can scale it up independently, and you can actually lower your organization's overall costs because you have a bunch of small services that consume smaller amounts of total power, smaller boxes in the cloud, or even smaller physical hardware. And then my favorite benefit is actually nothing to do with cost. It's developer experience. You have a better context of what you're working on. So, hey, I need to fix a bug in the email service. I don't have to dig through a mountain of code to find it. It's in the email service. I pull up the email service. I start digging through it, fix the bug there. I can deploy that without deploying everything else. And so I can get a fix out to production much faster, depending on how your organization is set up for, continuous deployment or delivery and integration tests, those sorts of things.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you download the code for a monolith and you're like, I don't even know where to start. But you download a singular serverless function or something, and like it takes you 20 minutes to get through the entire code base, if that.
Yeah.
I can see how that could be really beneficial. What are some of the costs from a maintainability standpoint of like serverless or not serverless, but microservices, which I use the term interchangeably by mistake, but they are often tied together pretty closely. So a microservices architecture, what are some of the costs associated to that kind of architecture?
Yeah, like I mentioned very briefly earlier, in my mind, the biggest cost is training. It's a whole new design system. It's a different paradigm, and it comes with its own advantages and disadvantages. Monoliths are easier to understand in some ways. You have a single code base. I don't have messages firing somewhere that get responded to by a different service. I'm trying to remember what it's called in the book that I just read about it. It's very much like a conductor, right? There's one system up front that's saying this, all right, now this, now this, now this, now this. With microservices, I feel like the biggest con has to do with the maintenance of the design system. It's more complex. It's a different paradigm. You have to consider events being responded to by another service. Where a monolith is actually in some ways simpler. Your monolith says, hey, I have a conductor, like an orchestra, somebody up front that's saying, now do this, now do this, now do this. And it's all visible to you once you understand the code base. With microservices, it's more like choreography. You have every individual piece, every person in the performance knows what they need to do. They know when to respond to certain actions. And you don't need that person up front saying, okay, now do this, now do this, now do this. So it's choreography versus a conductor is a simple way to break it down.
Right. Yeah. And it's just like everything, like nothing comes without trade-offs, and it depends on what types of trade-offs that you want to make. And I find it, I don't, concerning may not be the right word, but that's the word I'm going to use, when people just write something off because of a familiarity issue. And so like they say, well, I don't want to do this thing because the training cost is going to be hard because nobody's familiar with this. Well, yeah, okay. But like we're constantly training people all the time, and you know, you can train them in the old way of doing things, or you can train them in the new way of doing things. You're going to train them either way. And so let's set that aside as an equal cost either way. Sure. And you know, not to brush that off, because like familiarity does, you know, if you need to get moving fast, then sure, go with what you're familiar with. But I guess I have more thoughts about that, but I want to move on. We talk about this in terms of back end, and it makes a lot of sense.
It does get more complex on back end too. I mean, most of the time, you know, in a modern tech stack, it's not just I have 10 different servers running. It's I have 10 different like Docker images, and you have Kubernetes involved. And that's where I love having people who know way more about that than I do and work with them so I can get help.
There's not really any such thing as a full stack developer anymore. Nobody knows the whole thing, at least not at scale.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah, it's remarkable how complex things have gotten. And also at the same time, how easy it is relative to what it used to be to build something of value and useful in the world today. Like I could build a full app all on my own, because the platform as a service and different services that I could use to kind of, you know, fill in the gaps of my own knowledge, which I think is really quite cool. So talking about the front end, because that's where I spend most of my time as well. How does this microservice architecture apply to the front end?
Yeah. Microservices in the front end is a relatively new concept. This is where I think we as front-end engineers haven't done a great job of learning from our peers. At the end of the day, we're just solving problems. And we have peers who are doing it on servers, and we're doing it in browsers. We're working together to solve a problem, to build a web application or something else. And I think overall, we haven't done a great job at watching how the industry has moved to micro front-ends. A pendulum swing both ways. Some people are pushing microservices, and some people are pushing monoliths, and there's pros and cons. In the front end, it's really new. There was months ago, there was a disagreement on Twitter, massive Twitter thread about micro front ends. And I felt pretty great. I got a famous person to like one of my tweets. But ultimately it's all about, trying to make things better in development, in shipping code, in maintaining code. And sometimes that requires a paradigm shift. So if your backend at your company is already on microservices, you sort of have this disconnect, right? Where I've got this email service, and I want to deploy a change in the front end for email code. Well, I have to deploy the whole front end. Oh, I can't because there's a bug that hasn't been fixed since our last build over in the contact area. You can end up locked, and you kind of have to, you are blocked by deployments. Hmm. Where with microservices in the front end, you can create these whole silos. Like I have an email front end, I have an email back end, and I can deploy things as needed. Maybe I rewrite a whole front end from one framework to another. As long as the API with the back end doesn't change, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm thinking about this in the context of a large application like the one I worked on at PayPal. And at PayPal, I owned one app. And then there was another team that owned another app, and like we linked between each other, but we were totally separate, completely different entirely. Like the user clicks on this link and it's a full page refresh to get them over to this other app. Right. They're downloading React, but it's a different version. Or even if it's the same version, they're just downloading it again, bundled differently, you know, like, cause we're all totally different. I can see how that could probably be improved. So is that the kind of thing that can be solved by use it, like being intentional. So I guess what I'm saying is we sort of had a microservice front-end architecture, but it wasn't implemented well because we had these different parts of the overall PayPal.com app that were each route was like handled by a completely different app. But because it wasn't, intentionally designed as a microservice front end, we ended up giving the user a less positive experience. And so I guess that my question is building up to an assumption that this is the type of problem that microservices in the front end is intended to solve.
Yeah, absolutely. What you're talking about is essentially an integration layer. So you need a little bit of client-side code that's like, hey, when I'm at this route, show this application. When I'm at that route, show that application. And I actually work on an open source project that provides a lot of that for the people for free. But I want to talk about it generally before I plug.
Yeah, sure. No worries.
But yeah, it's an integration layer is what you're missing there. And that could prevent those full page reloads and give your users a better experience. And you right. can have lazy loading within the applications, which I assume you already had. Mm-hmm. You could say, hey, only load React once, and it's the same version. You could, hey, only load my design system, my CSS, my shared component library once, and it's the same for both applications. So it does, that's what, when I talk about additional complexity, that's exactly the sort of thing I'm talking about. You have different teams that have to coordinate at a higher level, but the end result is a better experience for users, a better experience for developers, and a better experience for DevOps or even just deployments in general and QA.
Right. Yeah. And that makes sense. So like if Sam at PayPal, we've got these two apps and we're like, users are going back and forth between our apps. We've got to solve this. So let's just make, we've got to make it so they're not downloading React twice. They're not downloading our component library and all this stuff twice. So let's just put all of our stuff together and we'll just, all in one repo, we'll deploy it together and everything. And so then our developer experience is shortchanged big time in favor of the user experience. And so what you're saying is we can solve that same problem without losing that improved developer experience by saying, okay, well, we're going to trade a little bit of our developer experience by, saying now we have to coordinate what versions of stuff we're using, but we'll be able to keep ourselves in our separate repositories. Or I suppose this could probably even work in a mono repo. In any case, that we'd be able to just work in our own section of the app without causing the problems for our users. So actually that question or that thought process made me think of a question. Is part of the goal of this microservices intended to make it possible for you to have separate repos, or is that a separate goal?
That's a separate goal. Me and the rest of the maintainers of the single spot of project that I work on, get that question a lot. Like, can I do this in a mono repo? Can I do this in, individual repos? And what we found is that most people actually prefer having dozens of small repos than a mono repo, but it'll work either way. Mm-hmm. I mean, the end goal is independent deployability. Yeah, I want to make a change in one area and deploy it and not have to coordinate with anyone else. I don't want to have to deploy everything just to make a small change.
Gotcha. Yeah, very cool. And that also means that, I guess that's the ultimate goal. And then how you want to implement where the repo is, where the code lives for each one of these is irrelevant. Very cool. Yeah, that's interesting. So does this mean that... single SPA, since we're kind of getting into that here, or any implementation of a microservice front end architecture, like any library, is basically like a router, and that's pretty much all it does, or is there more to it than just being a router?
There, conceptually, I think it's easiest to think of single SPA and other front end in the browser. Integration layers as a simple router. It's a higher level router, I don't want to confuse that with higher level components, but you know, I'm routing between applications rather than I'm routing between components. And I know that an application is really just a component. So in the end, it's not that much different.
But
you could even take that a step further, which is originally why Singles File was developed, saying like, hey, let me back up there. We had a problem at Canopy where Singles File was developed. We had an AngularJS monolithic application. And that application did everything, and we needed to migrate it to React. So there's lots of different ways we could have accomplished that. We could have used ng-react to let Angular render React components. But ultimately, then Angular still controls the routes. And at that point, it becomes very difficult to get rid of AngularJS entirely without a larger scale rewrite. So you get some of that developer experience, but not all of it. And honestly, adapters are pretty big, like bundle size.
Right.
And you have to rewrite anything anyways. So instead of saying, oh, I'll migrate this as a whole, which I've personally never seen work really well, you just sort of take a hammer to your existing thing and break it up into chunks. And then you carve section, you carve boxes around that chunks based on routes, and you say, hey, you know, this is this application, this application, that application, and you migrate those applications without routers. Without an adapter. You migrate those applications without an adapter, and then they're small enough, you can migrate them sort of that, not a big bang, but a big bang migration, but a small bang migration.
Bigger than a one day bang normally.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So, I'm just trying to think how this is much different from if I were deciding, hey, I want to switch from AngularJS to React. I'm going to build my own router with the history module, and then I'll just use code splitting for everything, and then load this bundle or that bundle. Is that basically what Single Spot does, or does it offer more than just doing that?
It's basically what it does. I think it offers more than that because we've done it in production for four and a half years now. So we've developed best practices to help accomplish those things. So one of the tools that we use is a tool called System.js. That's an open source polyfill for a proposed browser specification, which is a mouthful. But that lets you asynchronously load modules, and you can combine that with Single Spa, which is that top level router, just like you said. And you could load whole applications at runtime in the browser dynamically. So I could just define, hey, here's a list of all the possible applications, and load them when you need to. And they know everything they need to know. And these are the routes that they should be active. And that's all I have to tell Single Spa. And then I have the supercharging power of System.js to load those bundles. So yes, that's a long way for me to say, yes, that's essentially what it is.
Gotcha. So I'm curious about the ability to share versions of React and share other modules like that. So we say we have a design system, a CSS library, or even a React component library. How do I instruct Single Spa and my applications that these two applications use the same version of a given dependency? What do I need to change in my apps, and what do I need to tell Single Spa about that, or do I?
Yeah, that's actually where System.js comes in. Because System.js is the asynchronous module loader, it also has a module registry, so that when you load a module, you can get it from the module registry. It just caches it. And that operates like a singleton module. So there will only ever be one version of React. And so you load React with System.js, and then when you build your projects, whether you're using Webpack or MooTools or Rollup, you say, hey, don't include React.
Got it.
And then when System.js loads your bundle, it will give your bundle React.
That makes total sense. Total sense. So here in the last few minutes, I want to give you a chance to convince me to not build my own single spa. why should people, it sounds to me like this is something worthy of investigating, for especially for any team that has multiple projects, and especially like companies like PayPal, where you're doing a full page redirect over to one separate app, where it'd be a lot nicer for users to be able to just link directly to it and client-side routing kind of thing. So why, for people in that situation, why should they give single spa any attention?
Yeah, versus building it themselves. Is that
correct? Yeah, versus building it themselves.
I think that's a really great question. I it's hard for me to like say, don't build it yourself, because we built it ourselves. But my argument for why you shouldn't is that right now you have a battle tested, been in production for 5 years, framework essentially, that lets you build micro front ends. There's a large community behind it. There's several thousand stars on GitHub, and that alone should sell you. It has an active community of maintainers. It has a bunch of dev tools we've built for it. We even built a CLI to help you get started. So you could just say, create single spa React, and you're going to create a React single spa application, which is really just a React application with a slightly different Webpack config. And so for me, I say, don't build it yourself, because we've already done so much of the hard work. How do you handle hash routing versus browser HTML5 push state routing? How do you prevent applications from being active? How do you unmount applications? What if applications are written in different frameworks? We've solved all of those problems multiple times. And we have a battle-tested library with good unit tests with an active community behind it. I think it'd be equivalent saying, why shouldn't I build my own Webpack? Maybe not quite as big. Not quite as big. But don't build your own Webpack, because it's hard to build and it takes a lot of time and energy and resources. Don't build your own single spa. There's already one out there, and we would love for you to come help us make it even better. We're looking for open source contributors all the time. We get people from the community jumping in to help solve issues, add features. Don't build your own. Use ours and help us make ours better. And then the rising tide can lift everyone's applications.
Yeah, very good. I think that's a compelling argument for sure. So, Justin, you also, just in this last little bit, you also co-organize a conference that's near and dear to my heart. It's also near and dear to my home, so I like it especially much. It's Utah JS Conf. It's actually, I don't know if you know this, but this is the first conference I ever spoke at, was Utah JS Conf. Just awesome. And actually, Utah JS also has meetups and stuff. That was the first place I ever spoke, period, was at a Utah JS meetup. So why don't you tell us about Utah JS Conf 2020? And what are your plans here?
Yeah, Utah JS 2020 is shaping up to be a really awesome conference. We actually have our call for papers open now, and that's gonna stay open until the end of April, I believe. But the conference itself is on Friday, September 18th. We're really excited about it. We're holding it at the Jordan Commons Movie Theater again. It's worked out really well.
That's an awesome venue. I actually really like that venue. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, honestly, you get the tumblers, you have free soda, and everyone's just hyped up on caffeine and jittery the whole time. It's great. I've had a lot of fun working on Utah JS Conference. It's a nonprofit. So we are, our tickets relative to other conferences are much cheaper, and we get a lot of awesome speakers who are willing to, some cases even waive their speaking fees because we're a nonprofit. And the revenue that we make, which isn't much, from the conference itself, we turn around to use for the meetups. And so that's where the funding from the meetups comes from. We don't have our final ticket price this year yet, but when we open up our ticket sales in the probably sometime after CFP closes, when we know a little bit more about what social distancing looks like in September, we're really excited about it. It's been fun to work on, and I'm excited to see what cool proposals come up this year.
Yeah, I'm excited to go. And I hope that I don't have to stand 6 feet away from you, because I always like giving you a big hug. but yeah, Justin, is there anything else that you want to bring up before we wrap things up here?
I microservices has pros and cons, just like everything. I think the cons of microservices are way outweighed by the pros. That's a weird way to say that, but I think that the pros of microservices give you more than the cons cost you. I would encourage everyone to check out microservices generally on the back end and on the front end. Recognize that it not every organization it's going to be a great fit for. It really depends on your team structure, your application structure, and the cost that you're willing to absorb to get those great experiences. So consider microservices, check out some documentation. Generally, there's books available. Check out SingleSpa specifically. The website is singlespa.js.org. We've got an intro video there that's pretty great. Should give you a high level overview. It even has some amazing animations.
Sweet. Awesome. Hey, thank you so much. And that is our call to action, our homework for you all listening, to check out that single spot intro video. It is only 1 minute and 56 seconds long. So if you don't do it, then you are super lazy. No, just kidding. but everybody should have enough time to take a look at that and enjoy those cool animations Justin's talking about. Thanks so much for coming on, Justin. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you and chat. And I hope everything goes well with you these next few months and getting ready for Utah JS. And hope to see people around at the conference in a few months.
Yeah, I'm excited for the conference. It's always good. It's always fun to watch. And I'm excited to see you there.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Justin. We'll see you all later.